attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea either.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host Conrad.
Hello.
And in this episode, we are joined by David Tobe from the think tank Quilliam, the head of social policy at Quilliam. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Hi, guys.
First of all, I'd like to ask, for those of our listeners that might not be familiar with Quilliam, what is it that you do with the think tank?
Right, well, Quilliam is the world's first counter-extremism think tank. It was founded by people who, by and large, and there are some exceptions to this, but by and large came out of militant, what people often describe as extremist Islamist organisations, principally Hizb ut-Tahrir. And about a decade ago, there was a great movement out of Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir is an interesting organisation because it recruits really, or certainly was recruiting at the time, very much the brightest and the best. Mm. And these were people who are hugely charismatic, very intelligent, incredibly hardworking, and also independent thinkers. And the problem with recruiting a bunch of independent thinkers to an extremist organization is that at some point, some of them are going to say, hang on a second, guys, this isn't right. And that's what happened to a generation of people who were in Hizb ut-Tahrir. So they came out, founded Quilliam, which exists not just to focus on Islamist extremism, but on extremism of all types. And by extremism, we really mean a political activity, a way of looking at the world, which is inimical to the fundamental precepts of liberal democracy, by which we all naturally think of equality between persons, fundamental human rights, the primacy of democracy, and so on.
So there seems to have been sort of like less Islamist sort of extremism in the news recently. Obviously, you had, you know, ISIS seemed to have gone quiet for now. Hopefully that's a permanent thing and that's not just temporary. But what do you think the reasons for this are?
Well, it's worth remembering that in terms of, it's always very difficult to think about which areas of extremism are the worst and to come to a sort of firm conclusion about that, because you may well have small pockets of very, very intense and dangerous radical and violent extremist politics in some parts of the political spectrum, but a softer and more widespread iteration of it in others. It also really sort of turns on where attacks have taken place. And because we are living in a global news economy, attacks that happen anywhere in the world, if they are eye-catching and if they are unusual, dominate the headlines. I mean, we have seen a range of attacks coming from a broad variety of sources. And we've seen both attacks by Islamist groups and attacks by anti-Muslim bigots and haters and white supremacists, neo-Nazis, who have attacked both Jewish and Muslim targets. So, you know, these things are very much dependent, I think, on what's happened in the last few months. People's memories are very short, and one atrocity tends to block out another in the public imagination. But, I mean, certainly, you know, in terms of the actual creation of a state where the sort of attacks which would make the news if they were one-off by a neo-Nazi group, that in Syria and Iraq formed the basis of an entire state, and every day attacks of that nature were being committed against a defenseless and innocent population.
A couple of episodes ago, I was speaking to Dan Murdoch, who's a filmmaker who's made lots of documentaries about extremist groups, particularly in America. And he said that he'd noticed from 2015, when he made a documentary about the KKK, to sort of now, that the methods through which extremism are presented have changed, and a lot more of it is happening online. Do you think that the best way to tackle extremism now is perhaps not necessarily on the ground, but through the internet, through websites, through social media?
Possibly, yes. I mean, the best way of fighting political extremism of any sort is to create a culture which is firmly anti-extremist in nature. You know, there's a limit to what a government can do. There's a limit to what a education process in schools or, you know, through the internet can do. The only thing that really can effectively combat extremism is having a culture which resists it where and wherever it arises. I mean, one of the things that often happens to people when they're drawn into their own sort of closed bubble extremist subculture is that they get cut off from other people. They don't hear countervailing arguments. People don't check them and say, are you sure about that? And have you had a chance to look at some other ways of considering the particular issue you're thinking about? So one of the most notable recurring features of terrorist plots in Britain that have been successfully thwarted have been that family members and acquaintances have gone to authorities and said something quite serious is going on. We don't really know how many other cases there have been where people have been sort of drawn back from the brink by somebody who said, look, you know, I can see you're very angry and upset about something, but you may be looking at this the wrong way. And those are successes which we'll never hear about because they never ended up creating horrific headline grabbing atrocities.
So back in 2013, Quilliam did some work and managed to sort of get Tommy Robinson to quit the EDL. But since then, obviously, he's still risen once again to be a major figure in sort of the right, far right in the UK. What do you think sort of the mistakes were made there that sort of led to him sort of returning to that fold?
Well, my personal view on that man is that he's a grifter. He's essentially a person who has, look at it from his point of view. You become in a sort of 4 or 5 year period the most notorious sort of stirrer in Britain. You are at the head of marches which march past people's places of worship, causing fear and apprehension. And then suddenly you have an opportunity to get out. What do you do after then? And he's a man who really has very little going for him in his life, other than the most successful thing that he's ever done, which is to be the head of a Muslim baiting organization. And really, I think after a short period of time, he was a man who found himself with no real visible means of support. You know, how do you go back to normal life after doing that sort of thing? And it's a question really that applies not just to people like Tommy Robinson, but to people who come out of any form of extremist subculture, particularly where you've been very successful in it. There needs to be something else that people can do. And for most people, that's going to involve going back to ordinary life, you know, getting a qualification, getting a job, you know, fading into anonymity and obscurity. But if you're a person who sees that there's an opportunity to continue making a living, to have your vanity flattered, the lure of going back into what you've been most successful at doing is going to be irresistible. And I think if you look at the sort of trajectory that Tommy Robinson took after the attempt by Quilliam to wean him away from the sort of agitation that he was involved in, he was picked up by effectively a Canadian alternative media conglomerate. He realized that there was a lot of money to be made doing that. He went off and founded his own similar operation where all of the profits were coming to him, and he's done extremely well out of that. And then extremely dispiritingly, aspects of the American, what might almost have said before their dalliance with Tommy Robinson, mainstream right, took him on as a cause. And one of the most depressing things of the last couple of years was seeing the Middle East Forum, which had been, you know, in many ways a sort of respectable organization, putting out a message to their supporters that Tommy Robinson was a brave fighter for freedom and liberty whose life was in danger. Now, look, you know, Quilliam is a very small organization. It doesn't have that sort of money. It wasn't offering to Tommy Robinson an opportunity to do anything which was even vaguely on the level of the sort of opportunities he's had on the US and the self-generated style side of things. And I think, you know, if from a purely commercial point of view, he made a prudent decision, but not one which really has done the country any good.
You spoke about the right in America, element of the right in America embracing Tommy Robinson. How much do you think that the mainstream of political parties, whether they be right or left, are to blame for a more extreme tone in our political debate because they are willing to accept and support figures who are on the extreme of both politics and society?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a UK or a US phenomenon only, it's a global phenomenon. We've seen the collapse of the social democratic liberal center. We've in a range of countries. France was almost the most notable victim, where had it not been for Macron, there would have been a direct polarization between the choice of the far left or the far right. And it is, I mean, this is one of the my recurring themes. I think we spend too much time talking about combating extremism. I mean, when we say extremism, what do we really mean? And what we mean is, a politics that opposes, the liberal democratic values we've talked about. I've always thought that instead of talking about being anti-extremists, it's better to be talking about the virtues of liberal social democracy, of pluralist societies. And it's by having that sort of strong politics that we have the strongest bulwark against extremism. But, you know, horror and sensation tends to capture the agenda of even the most mature democracies from time to time. And we're going through that period at the moment. My sincere and profound hope is that within the next decade, we will have developed resilience as a culture to that sort of polarized, conspiracist, hate-driven, sensation-seeking worldview. The problem is, I think that we face is that people have seen pluralist liberal democracy as a kind of default position. It's as natural as the air or the water. You know, it just is there. You don't have to strive to create it, you don't have to defend it. And one of the things that we've learnt in this country and in a number of other countries is that that is not in fact the default position. If you don't work hard to support it, if you don't oppose threats to it, it will collapse. And that, I'm afraid, is something that we've seen happening in a more than one country.
So is it your view then that there is sort of been a rise in extremism in the UK recently in politics? Because from the way I've sort of seen it, I mean, I think that if anything, if you think about sort of 10 years ago when you had Nick Griffin on Question Time, you know, an open racist person who was an MEP, elected, and there's two BNP MEPs actually. Whereas now, like the Brexit Party, though it's sort of, you know, it's sort of, although it might be more sort of right wing than most people, it's not in the same vein as what we've seen in the past. So, I mean, could you not say that there's been less extremism in politics?
It's an interesting question. We certainly had a very, very clear bogeyman in the BNP. One of the interesting things about the BNP is that you'd see polling for the policies of the BNP, and they would often have widespread support within the country at large. What put people off the BNP was that they were very, very obviously a Nazi party, and that everything that they did to try to rebrand, as many European fascist parties did, were unsuccessful at persuading the public that they were not to be touched with a barge pole. So, you know, you would have the polling which would say, do you agree with these policies? And you go through a list of things that the BNP said that they were in favour of. And then you would finally ask the polling subject, the BNP has these as its policies, would you vote for them? And an overwhelming majority of people would absolutely reject them out of hand, because they knew what the BNP was. Now, I don't regard the Brexit Party or UKIP as a neo-fascist party in disguise, because they're clearly not. But they're certainly a party who have managed to latch on to a number of populist themes which focus on things that we often associate with extreme politics, including a sense that there is a conspiracy against the general population by elites. At the same time, we've also seen genuinely new political movements which are closer to fascist and neo-Nazi parties, but also come from a different tradition. And I'm thinking here of identitarian movements, groups like Generation Identity, where there, you know, there may be a membership which includes people who have had their political training, so to speak, in traditional parties of the far right, but who are focusing less on a racial analysis of politics and more on a cultural analysis. And that to some degree has allowed them in some countries, not in the United Kingdom, but in France, for example, to make greater inroads, because they do look dissimilar, particularly in the way that they present themselves. And these groups often talk about optics as something very different from what had come before, and not simply a attempt to rebrand old style Nazi nostalgia politics, which very much characterized the far right of the 70s and 80s, and to a lesser extent the 90s.
Now, you mentioned the transformative nature of far-right parties in an attempt to rebrand themselves. In the Labour Party, we've seen a lot of people who would have perhaps previously in the history of the Labour Party been seen as on the extreme of the party now being involved in the very heart of it. And a lot of people have done this via, you know, the cloak of new politics, new better politics under Corbyn. How important do you think it is to point out within mainstream parties, whether they be the Labour Party with anti-Semitism and people in the past who have held views that are perhaps not akin to the mainstream of the Labour Party, who are now in charge of it, and in the Conservatives you can say similar things. How important do you think it is to point out that though both parties might say this is normal, that it isn't actually normal, the language that they might be using, or the people that they are supporting and are allowing into their ranks?
I think political parties have failed to realise the extent to which the views and attitudes held by significant and often organised parts of their base have changed. The change within the Labour Party is a very stark and good illustrative example of that, in that absolutely everything that you see in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party now was evidently part, and a strong and a growing part, we might even say a part with momentum, of left politics for over a decade before the takeover of the Labour Party by that faction happened. So, you know, if you look at what brought Jeremy Corbyn to power. It wasn't a sudden sort of, you know, groundswell of people who had previously had no interest in politics and had not been politically involved at all. The Momentum movement was able to draw on a ecosystem of political organizations and campaigns, many of them quite cranky, which had been strong and active for a very long time. And I'm thinking about the people who came out of movements as diverse as some of the wackier ends of environmentalism, the Venezuela, the Putin, the Iranian, the Palestinian foreign policy based campaigns, and then other sort of more inchoate campaigns that had been, had burnt very brightly before burning out, like Occupy, which were treated as a sort of bright new dawn in British politics. The Guardian would run Occupy features for weeks at a time, until these effectively became a mainstream identifying part of what it meant to be a left-wing person. And they would overlap. So, you know, if you went to a Venezuela solidarity meeting, you'd probably get invited to go to a Cuba solidarity meeting. Mm-hmm. And that would gradually become your political and your social group. And a bubble of activism would be created, which a group like Momentum was simply able to draw upon and pull together. So these things don't just come out of thin air. I mean, they have a cultural and organizational precedent that all that's really required is for them to be deployed and turned to a particular political object for them to be potentially successful. Now, I don't see that in quite that way happening on the right of the political spectrum, but I think there's certainly a potential for it to do so. I mean, we are looking at the moment at a Brexit party, which is effectively a Farage fan club, which is able to get sort of between 10 and 25% of the population supporting it. What that doesn't have, or doesn't have in quite the same way that the variety of left groups that I talked about a moment ago, what they don't have is the mailing lists, the meetings, the people who are experienced in activism, who can be drawn on and sort of turned into a political machine. But I wouldn't sort of discount the possibility that at some point they might well become so. And to answer your question, the leadership of political parties often think that what matters is making the argument in the country as a whole, is what happens within the political party as it exists at a particular moment, the policies that political party are going to promote and they hope enact when in power. And you can be very focused on that, and particularly on the party and the Westminster side of things. But by doing that, you miss what's happening within the broader political culture of your part of the political spectrum. And one of the things that was really, really noticeable about the lead up to the first sort of great rebellion against Jeremy Corbyn within the Labour Party was that for a year or two, people weren't even capable of describing what it was that was wrong with Jeremy Corbyn's politics. Mm. I mean, almost the only thing you'd ever hear from people was, it's unpopular, we're going to lose an election, this isn't going to win over floating voters. There was almost no ability, no language to express what was intellectually and politically wrong with the sort of politics that was being promoted. So the short answer to your question is political parties need to be far cannier about threats which they face from within their own political tradition. And hopefully in future political parties will be less cavalier as dismissing them as the noisy and the unimportant fringe, which is very much what people would say when you'd say, look at what's happening within the Labour Party. It would simply be dismissed as trivial and unimportant. That's not what the Labour Party's really about. The Labour Party's really about building schools. It's about family credit. And those sort of things absolutely were the sort of things that ordinary voters cared about. But it wasn't the sort of thing which motivated the activists who were prepared to give up their weekends, their evenings, and indeed their lives to making a particular political vision a reality.
I wonder how much do you think that the way that the media presents extremism, whether it be in news reports or in fiction, in films or TV series, influences the way that we perceive extremism?
That's not something I've ever really thought about before. Anybody who works in a job and then sees a representation of that job or what it is you do from day to day in any form of fiction, particularly television series, is horrified by the inaccuracies. My background is as a lawyer, and I would there was a time when I used to watch legal dramas, and I've just given up doing it because the sort of things that happen in series about lawyers, by and large, would never ever happen in real life. Like most things, real life is much more boring than the way in which they're presented in 45-minute episodes of drama series. But at the same time, there is and always has been a kind of feedback between the way in which a job is represented on television and the way that the people who perform that job come to think of themselves. A very good example of it is during the 1970s, when Starsky and Hutch, the American cop series, was a staple of your British weekend viewing. Police cars' doors started to fall off. And the reason for that was that whenever Starsky and Hutch jumped out of a car, they would slam the door as hard as they could. In reality, a car door can only take that a few times before it starts sort of showing a little bit of metal stress. So, I think people... There has been a degree of glamorization of both extremism and the job of extremism hunting. But I think for most people who are actually sort of involved in the cold-faced work, it's much more boring and less exciting than it appears in television series. And the same thing must apply to people who are involved in extremist organizations. Four Lions is a great example of this because Four Lions is a film that I know is absolutely loved by all of the people who are on the Salafi jihadi fringe and everybody who's involved in counter extremism because it's the one film that really captures the silliness and the absurdity and the incompetence as well as the terrible outcome. Don't want to have any spoilers for people who haven't seen it yet. but of people going down that route. But it really gets the extent to which so many people who are involved in this sort of thing are essentially silly, and if it hadn't been for what they were doing, they'd be non-entities.
You mentioned earlier on about sort of environmental groups. Do you think sort of the tactics of things like Extinction Rebellion are sort of conversion to extremism, especially in the sort of future with more and more sort of climate change being in the news and people seeing it as such a big thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a focus, I think, on the non-violent law-breaking tactics of Extinction Rebellion. And I don't personally engage in, and I'm not an advocate of non-violent law-breaking, but I don't regard that as an inherently extremist path to go down. There has been environmental activism in the past, which has involved a degree of violent extremism. But what Extinction Rebellion is doing at the moment, and what it, the only things it's ever talked about doing don't strike me as imminently likely to go down that line. What I do find worrying about Extinction Rebellion is that they present either honestly because they believe it or cynically because they think it is motivating essentially an end times vision of the nature of the environmental challenge that we face. And I've it's quite difficult to pin down exactly what Extinction Rebellion think from their literature, and they spend a lot of time saying, you know, we'd like to have citizens' juries to actually investigate these issues. But if you look at their rhetoric, the very name Extinction Rebellion is premised upon something which they'll often say in meetings, which is we are a few years away from human extinction. Now, if you look at the best of the peer-reviewed environmental studies and the studies of studies, what they indicate is a very serious hit to human well-being that will be occasioned by environmental change if it is not addressed. But those studies, by and large, do not suggest that human extinction is on the cards. And that there is, I think, something worrying about effectively telling people very simplistically, perhaps just in order to motivate them, what you're doing at the moment is going to save the whole of the human race from going down the tube. That is I think a grossly irresponsible way of conducting politics, instilling in people not simply a sense that there is a need to do something urgently, but that if you don't, the world will come to an end, is something that potentially does lead on to a greater challenge of extremism. And I have been to Extinction Rebellion meetings where that has been said, and in which it's been made very clear that unless the things that the Extinction Rebellion group think need to be done, then we will be facing curtains for the human race, and that just isn't true. But then they go on and say, and you will be arrested. And if you go to prison, prison won't be so bad. I went to a meeting in which a person who had been to prison a number of times in over the past couple of decades talked about his life in prison. And he basically said, it's like a holiday camp, and here's your room, and, you know, this is what you'll be able to do, and it really won't be so bad. The reason that they want people to be imprisoned, incidentally, is because there is a social change theory which suggests that if a certain percentage of the population is prepared to get itself arrested, then at that point, support for the people who've been arrested is so great that the demands of the group become irresistible. And I can understand, you know, why you go down that route, but I think it's it is... one that I favour considerably less than simply making the case honestly, proposing workable, practical solutions, and then encouraging people to support that through the ordinary democratic process. That can be done, and it should be done, but it's not the way that Extinction Rebellion seems to me to be set up to operate.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast now. Thank you for being on, David.
It's my pleasure.
I'd like to ask you one final question. Now, we've seen dancing quite a bit in politics in the last few years with Theresa May's premiership, and today more celebrities have been announced to participate in the current series of Strictly Come Dancing.
We really are talking about not metaphorical dancing, but actually dancing.
They are actually dancing.
Okay.
If you were ever offered the opportunity to participate in Strictly Come Dancing or any other reality television program, would you do it?
I would certainly not do anything involving dancing. I can tell you, I loved my wedding day. I got married almost 2 decades ago, and it really was the happiest day of my life. But all the way through my wedding, I was dreading the moment where I'd have to do the first dance, because dancing is something I do incredibly badly. I'm much better in the studio with a microphone in front of me.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast, David. We look forward to having you on again at some point.
Lovely to talk to you.
Well, you can, if you wish to, contact us at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @debatedpodcast and like us on Facebook, again, @debatedpodcast. So thank you for listening to the episode, and I hope you'll listen to the next one.